Well, good morning. You may have noticed we have a new piece of furniture on the stage. That is not without purpose. I'm going to make use of it right now, if you don't mind, with the temptation that it's really nice preaching from a couch. But the purpose of this couch is actually to illustrate this point that when I was a kid, we had this way of handling disputes in our family. And what would happen if I was fighting with my brother, which is usually what the dispute was, is that we would be sent to the living room, not the kind of comfortable family room, but the formal living room, and we would be told to sit on the couch together until we could honestly say that our differences had been worked out. So we usually started, you know, kind of like this over there, and all frustrated, and eventually it just got old to sit on the couch doing nothing, and so we kind of worked it out and came a little closer, and eventually that helped us to kind of sit through something together and talk about it and figure out what might be going on and come to some resolution. Well, today we're finishing up Galatians, and we're looking at the last chapter. Last week we started looking at these last two chapters, and we saw that they're kind of the pinnacle of the book. The whole book is kind of driving toward these chapters. And the point of them is, how do you love each other once you become a family? Paul's point in this book is that the gospel brings us together under God as a family, and the question then becomes, how do you live that out? How do we love each other? And like any good gift from God, families can be the source of some of the deepest joys and most intense just celebrations on earth. And like any good gift from God, families can be the source of some of the deepest hurts and most intense pains and struggles and disappointments. So if we're going to figure out how to live as a family, we're going to go through those things together. High highs and low lows. Misunderstandings, confusions, flared tempers, joys, celebrations. Really great things going on in our lives. So my image for us this morning that I want us to have is sitting on the couch together. The gospel has made us brothers and sisters. We've come together under God. We've been adopted together into his family. So figuring out what that means sometimes is going to take sitting on the couch together. So we're going to look at Galatians 6 this morning and see how we can do that. It's on page 1155 in your pew Bibles. And this chapter is often kind of thought of as just a bunch of miscellaneous kind of suggestions for the community. But it really has this in common. How do you live out this love as a family? And the common theme is doing good. Doing good to each other. So this morning we're going to sit on the couch and do good. And that's basically it. Sounds simple, right? Well, one of the problems is that this word good has lost most of its meaning in English. It's kind of like the ice cream flavor vanilla. How many people, their favorite flavor is vanilla? Not a lot. See, the rest of us don't even really think of vanilla as a flavor. So you guys are kind of alone in that. We think of vanilla as like blank, and then you add something to it. But to be fair, and for me, it's as much chocolate as you can get. You know, chocolate ice cream, chocolate ribbon, all sorts of that. But to be fair, vanilla is actually a flavor. I know, shocking, what you learn in church. But and in the same way, this idea of good actually means something. These words, Paul uses two Greek words that are essentially synonymous to refer to this idea, but they're powerful words. It's good, not like, oh, how are you doing? Oh, I'm good. It's not that. It's like Frodo Baggins is good and Sauron is evil, right? That's the type of good. It's like God created the universe and he looked down and he said, boy, that's good. That's something. These powerful notions of good. So that's the type of good that we want to do to each other. Not mediocrity, not okayness, not niceness or politeness, but good. And Paul summarizes this in verse 10, which reads in the NIV, "Let us do good to all people, especially to those who belong to the family of believers." And I think that last phrase is really curious to me, because usually we think about doing good to the world. We think about loving the world and showing them God's love in that way. But Paul seems to say that this place is a particular place where good should be done. That somehow the love that's shown to each other here is also a testimony to the world. So Paul tells the Galatians to do good to each other. He says, sit on the couch and do good to your brother. And he goes through a bunch of specific issues. The first one he addresses is, what do you do when your brother is doing bad? What do you do when you find out that somebody here in this room is cheating on their spouse? Or stealing money from their company? Or hating their in-laws? Or looking at pornography? Or ignoring the needs of the world? How do you do good when your brother is doing bad? Well, let's look at verse 1. What happens if one of you finds out that another one is engaged in some sinful activity? Well, one of the brothers and sisters who is walking in relationship with God's Spirit should try to persuade this one gently to reform his ways. But he should also be careful not to be led astray himself, since sin can be so appealing. So what do you do when your brother is doing bad? You do good. Right. You catch that? You do good. Thank you. Very nice. But there are a few qualifications Paul has in here, a few kind of descriptions about what good looks like. And I think he does this because he understands that our tendency is to go back to this game that we've been talking about, this idea of figuring out who I am compared to someone else. So let's speculate for a moment. Let's say that everybody in this room is playing the game, that we're all trying to figure out who we are by making sure that we're better than somebody else. Okay? I know that's the farthest thing from the truth, so let's just kind of stretch our imaginations. And let's say that I find out that one of you is having an affair. Now, if I have any skills at this game at all, I'm going to recognize that this is a great opportunity for me. See, this is a chance for me to get ahead. This is a chance for me to pass you up in the game. So if you're playing the game, your sin becomes my opportunity for superiority. Your sin becomes a chance for me to feel better about myself. And I'm not likely to be so explicit about it. I'll probably talk to you gently, and I'll probably try and be nice. But underneath it all, there might be this sense of victory, of superiority. Rachel and I are big fans of the TV show The Office, and I don't think we've ever missed an episode, which is quite a boast. But but in a recent episode, they had this business ethics discussion. So the HR person had to lead a session on business ethics, and one of the issues was stealing time from the company. So Dwight, who's kind of the office goody boy, right, pipes up and says, I've never stolen any time from the company. Well, that's a challenge. So Jim, one of the other characters, decides to time Dwight to see how much time he might actually be stealing. So he starts doing that, and sure enough, a yawn costs the company almost 4 seconds. Jim points this out to Dwight, and then Dwight, getting angry at Jim for using a stopwatch for timing his yawn, that costs the company over 15 seconds. So you can see that Dwight's claim wasn't really true. Now, Jim wasn't doing good to Dwight. He wasn't approaching him out of concern, out of love. He wanted to show him that he wasn't as good as he thought he was. And that's kind of an extreme example, but I think sometimes we can respond that way with each other. We can jump on somebody who might be struggling in some area, might be wrestling with sin, and we can make them feel condescended upon, inferior. We can play the game. Treat them like bumper cars. But what the gospel does is it frees us up not to be like that. It frees us up to have genuine concern and actually to love each other here. And Paul's qualifications kind of help to play that out, to help to say, how does that work out in practice? So he says, first, someone who is spiritual, someone who is confident of their relationship with God and how that affects their relationship with others, that should be the person that talks to the one in sin. Second, they should do so gently, carefully. And third, they should do so recognizing that they have just as much susception to sin. They're just as likely to get tangled up in sin themselves because sin is so attractive. And what those qualifications do is they end up leveling the field. It ends up making everybody equal under the gospel. So if I come to you to talk to you about some area that you're struggling, and I recognize that I am just as likely as you are to struggle in that way or another way, I can't feel superior to you. I can't play the game. All I can do is walk alongside you, sit on the couch with you, and draw us together up to God. And I'm also struck by the calmness in Paul's instruction here. See, he just gives kind of very natural instructions, as if he expects that in any community there's going to be people that engage in stuff, that this is, in a sense, normal. And I think it is. He doesn't say to get panicked. He doesn't say to just really worry a lot. He says to deal with it, but to do so calmly. Several years ago, when I was single, I was involved in a ministry, and I started to suspect, through pretty good knowledge, that one of the other members of the ministry was being sexually active in their dating relationship. And I was really concerned. I panicked, and I got all upset about it, and we got to, you know, sound the sirens and get everybody up to arms, and we got to talk to this person, we got to do all this stuff, and we got to fix this now. And I was right to be concerned, because that is dangerous behavior. But my panic, I don't think, was driven by love for that person or concern for the community. I think, honestly, my panic was that they were getting away with something that I certainly wanted to get away with, but wasn't. And so I was jealous of them, in a sense, not concerned. But that's the wrong way to respond to sin. We don't have to panic. Nobody gets away with sin. Sin has its own consequences. And we're all together in this effort to follow God and figure out what that looks like in this life. When someone is engaged in sin, our role is not to humiliate them, to become traffic cop, to catch them. It's to sit on the couch with them and do good and invite them back into a healthy way of relating to God. Do good to your brother when he does bad. Well, Paul moves on from this issue. And the next issue he talks about is, how do you respond to needs? In any family, when you get together, you have different types of needs. Financial needs, emotional needs, social needs. And the question comes up in a family, how do you address those properly? How do you figure out the balance between responding well to somebody who has a need that should be taken care of by the body, but not letting somebody abuse this system and always present their needs in a way that's not healthy? Well, Paul has kind of an interesting combination of two phrases to address this in verses 2 through 6. In verse 2, he says, carry each other's burdens. And then in verse 5, he says, for each one should carry his own load. So you kind of scratch your head and you say, well, which one is it? Do we carry each other's burdens or do we carry our own load? And I think what Paul is doing is kind of wading into this complexity of how needs operate in a family. And saying it's a combination of personal responsibility with sharing the load with each other. Let me read verses 2 through 5. You need to take care of each other's needs. This is how you follow the law that Christ lived by. But if someone thinks he is really more important than someone else, which is of course he isn't, then he's just lying to himself. So everyone should examine himself apart from comparing himself to another. That way he knows that he is acting rightly as best he is able and not trying to be better than anyone else. In that way, each person will be responsible for himself. So what do we do when we are in need? We do good. What do we do when each other is in need? We do good. Regardless of whether it's my need or your need, the response is to do good to each other. Let me share a little parable to kind of unpack this a little bit. A father had two sons. The older son was a successful lawyer in Boston, doing very well for himself. The younger son was an amateur musician, trying to make his mark on the world in San Diego. And it seemed like the dynamics of this family are that the younger son would always be asking the older son for money. It'd always be the same story, just a few hundred more dollars and my break is going to come in. If I could just get a little bit more, then I know something's going to happen and everything will be fine. And the older brother helped his younger brother But eventually he got tired, and eventually he started asking the question, is this ever really going to stop? Is anything ever going to change? Until one day, when the younger brother got a call from his older brother's wife. And she told him that his brother had died the night before. And as the story unfolded, the younger brother learned that the older brother had suffered through 3 years of a terminal illness. In fact, he'd gone through numerous painful treatments trying to address this condition, but eventually succumbed to it and died from it. And the first the younger brother heard about it was his brother's wife telling him that he had died. Two brothers. One brother who seems to think that his needs are always the responsibility of the family to take care of. Another brother who seems to think that his needs have no relationship to the family and wants to protect the family from knowing his needs. I think we can see that this idea that Paul's trying to get is somewhere in the middle. It's some bringing together of those two things. We can't hide our needs from each other. That's not living like a family. But we also can't demand that others meet our needs. The truth is that I think this passage is going to address each of us differently, depending on where we are. Some of us may need to share some needs with the body and let people around us know what has been hard. Invite others into carrying our burdens. Others of us may need to establish a little more personal responsibility and stop demanding that others meet our needs. Stop being resentful that people aren't responding to us more. Sometimes it might be different depending on your different relationships. This is what's true for me. For me, I tend to kind of in the larger community keep my needs more to myself because I tend to assume the role of caregiver. But that only lasts so long. And what happens for me often is I'll get home and I'll pour all my needs onto my wife and demand that she meet my needs because I haven't asked anybody else to. So for me, it's this thing of balancing, learning to ask more people into carrying my burdens, but with my wife to ask her less, to kind of share it more. So my encouragement for us is to do good in the midst of need. And I think one principle to guide that, one way that that looks like is sharing our needs, not holding them back like the other brother, sharing them with each other without demanding that they be met in a certain way, like the younger brother was doing. We share our needs openly and we let people respond how they might or might not be able to enter into that with us. Incidentally, this is the principle that guides our financial kind of policy here at PBC. Every year or every certain period of time, we share our financial status with the body, and we do that to let everybody know the current situation so that people can then be led individually how they might or might not respond. We're about to do that later in this service. So we don't keep everything to ourselves, saying that, oh, you guys don't really care about money and you don't need to know all that stuff. We don't need to share our needs. We don't take that perspective. But we also don't say, hey, here's the bottom line. You guys got to cough it up. Because that's not living like a family either. This principle of sharing our need and then letting you decide prayerfully with the Lord what it looks like to respond to that. And this brings us right into the third area that Paul addresses. We've talked about doing good in the midst of sin, doing good in the midst of needs, and now Paul himself kind of dives right into the issue of finances. What does it look like to do good with your money? And it makes sense that it would come up, because whenever you start talking about needs, financial needs tend to kind of bubble to the surface. In the past section, it's kind of a little bit hinted at, and now Paul gets a little more specific. Let me read verses 6 through 8. Those people among you who are charged with teaching the Bible to each other should be financially supported by the family. Don't fool yourselves. No one can get away with ignoring God. When someone plants a certain type of seed, that's the type of plant that he will harvest. In the same way, if someone acts only in accordance with his natural desires, that mindset will grow throughout the community and poison it. But if someone acts in accordance with their relationship with God, That mindset will grow throughout the community, and everyone will taste more of the life that comes from knowing God. So the final issue Paul addresses is how to do good with your money. Do good with your money. And he starts by encouraging people to support their local community of faith, to support their church. And he basically says that it's right, it's the right way for a family to act, that a family gets together and decides certain members of that family should be responsible for leading the family, for taking care of it by teaching scripture, and that those members should be supported by the family. Essentially, it's right that a church hire pastors. That's the normal way that a family should operate. It doesn't mean that anybody's getting away with anything. It doesn't mean that you need to feel manipulated into it or pressured into it. It's just that that's the right response for a family centered around God, to raise up certain people to do that. And as we talk about our budget later today, it'll be pointed out that a lot of our money is spent exactly on that, supporting people within this body who have been asked to lead it in certain ways. I think Paul is making the argument that that's appropriate. That's the way a family should operate. But he doesn't just stop with that. See, he wants to give people a bigger picture of how money fits into the kingdom of God. And so he uses this imagery of sowing and reaping. And his basic point is that what you get, what you pay for. If you sow your money in strictly natural sense, then that's all you're going to get. You might get security. Of course, in these days, you might not. But you might get security. You might get what you want. You might get some enjoyment out of it, but that's all. And that's a tragedy. Because what's true in the church, what he wants us to understand, is that normal everyday things like money and interactions with each other, our relationships, these everyday things are transformed into spiritual benefit in this place. If you use those things in a way that recognizes what God is doing here and the truth of the gospel, they have impact far beyond what they're ever meant to. In this place, physical things have spiritual effects. So it's funny, but in this place, something as simple as this, a little piece of paper that doesn't have much worth, really, can change somebody's life. Money can be used to give a high schooler the opportunity to encounter God for the first time. That's crazy. This can be transformed into the opportunity for somebody, for a couple who's struggling in marriage, to come together and to see God at work in their relationship, to be drawn up to something bigger. Something as simple as this can be used for a community to gather together on a Sunday morning and worship the Creator of the universe. That's incredible. Earthly things used in a spiritual way. And what we tend to do is separate out various aspects of our lives. I've been suggesting as we study Galatians that we tend to separate out the spiritual and the social. But in fact, our relationship with God has everything to do with our relationship with each other. And the same thing is true about our money. Our relationship with God has everything to do with how we spend our money. There's no divide between our spiritual lives and our economic lives. Now, this is a really uncertain time in our country, economically. That shouldn't be news to most of you. But what we believe about God is that He is unchanging. He is forever. He is eternal. He is not uncertain. In fact, He is the most certain thing that we have. And so what we have the privilege of doing in this place, because we believe in Him, because we believe that this place is this window on earth into God's kingdom, we have the chance to act on God's certainty rather than on the world's uncertainty. And that's what we've been talking about in Galatians. We can act on the certainty that I'm related to God, that I don't have to figure out who I am based on how I compare to you. And we have the certainty with our money to act on who God is rather than what might be happening in the world. You know, our culture tells a story about money. It goes something like this. As you get older and more established, you'll make more and more money. You'll hopefully have more and more time to spend it, and you'll enjoy it more and more. You basically progress forward in life as you earn more, spend more, and consume more. That's the American dream. That's the story that we are told. But the gospel tells us a different story about life. The gospel tells us a story about getting less and less, about being more and more consumed with God's kingdom and what he's doing in the world than with what's actually happening here. But not in a way that minimizes these casual interactions or minimizes our money. It's not that we forget about earthly things because they're below us. It's that we realize that those earthly things are the very stuff that gets translated into reality in God's kingdom. We can use earthly things for spiritual effect. And I'm always compelled by people that I hear stories of who see their lives, see their growth in terms of spending less and less, of giving more and more, of getting by with fewer things. And I want that for myself, but honestly, it's hard in this culture to figure out how to do that, to figure out what that actually looks like. One suggestion, kind of a practical suggestion I have for us that I've found helpful is to set up a separate bank account that you can use to give money into and then have sitting there waiting for needs that arise. You can use that account to give to church, to give to people you know that might have needs, to the world. And for us, we found this to give us a great freedom because it allows us to give money into one place. And then when somebody has a need, when we become aware of a need, we have the freedom to respond to it joyfully because we're just waiting to use that money. And it's coming slow, but what we hope to do as a family is to start giving more and more and more into that. Because once it's there, it's gone. It's given to somebody. And try to work on spending less and less. So this passage encourages us to do good with our money. Don't be fooled by thinking that money has nothing to do with God. Do good with your money. Well, we've been talking a lot about doing good, and there's just one last thing to mention. And it has to do with the fact that doing good gets old. It gets tiring. Let me read 9 and 10, verses 9 and 10. So don't get tired of doing good because it will have a positive effect in the lives of others and the health of the community in due time if you're persistent. Whenever you can, try to intentionally love someone else, especially your brothers and family, your brothers and sisters in the family of faith. So my last exhortation is to do good persistently. And it's simply reality that loving is hard, that it takes time to see the benefit of following God, of loving each other. And sometimes love doesn't seem to pay off. Sometimes we seem to get abused or taken for granted. But what Paul says here, what God promises us, is that our love will yield relational impact, that something good will come of it. And sometimes we just need to be reminded of that. So consider this your reminder. Do good persistently. It will pay off. That's what Paul's saying. Your energy spent in each other, in relationships, is worthwhile. It's eternal. Do good persistently. Well, the last half of this chapter, Paul kind of concludes by drawing all this together, by saying, this is how this is all possible. He kind of revisits this idea that we have been created as a family. He summarizes it in verse 15. The NIV reads there, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision means anything. What counts is a new creation. We generally understand this idea of new creation to be something personal, individual. But I think what he means here is the community. He means that there used to be two groups, uncircumcision and circumcision. Now there's a new creation. Now there's something new. I've created a new community defined by me. And this community stands outside of those groups. You don't need to be defined by where you fit. You're defined by who you believe in. This new creation is where you belong. And so we belong in this family. God is the Father, and we've been invited into it by Christ because of what he's done. And so we sit on the couch with each other. And when we do so, we realize that this couch has room for three. So we sit on the couch with our brother, with you, with each other, but we realize that Christ has become our brother by inviting us into relationship with the Father. And so Christ sits right here with us, among us, within us, working in our relationships, calling us to love each other in deep ways, and inviting us to do good, to live as a family. So my encouragement for us is to see the way that we relate to each other as moving from bumper cars to carnival swings, to loving each other, to see that the gospel frees us up to love and to do good here in this place. Well, this is kind of the end of our series in Galatians. So I'm going to wrap up by reading the last 8 verses of Galatians. I'm going to let Paul's words be our last words of this series. Here's Galatians 6, 11 to 18. Now I'll take the pen from my scribe and write a few last words of my own. But you'll have to excuse my terrible handwriting. Whoever it is among you who wants to show how good they are at getting people to follow them by convincing you to be circumcised is only trying to avoid the persecution that comes from preaching about the cross of Christ. The ironic thing is that even those people who are trying to get you to be circumcised don't even keep the law themselves. They just want you to be circumcised so they can brag about how many followers they have. But someone shoot me if I ever brag in any of my own accomplishments instead of bragging about what our Lord Jesus Christ has accomplished for us on the cross. It was at that cross that I stopped thinking that the world's ideas were important, and they stopped thinking that I was important. So it doesn't matter whether you are circumcised or whether you are uncircumcised. The only thing that matters is the new community that Christ has created out of us. So to whoever decides not to be circumcised, may you experience peace and mercy. And the same for those Jews among you who are already circumcised. To the rest of you, please stop trying to cause me trouble. Don't you realize that my own body shows how much I have suffered on behalf of Jesus? May the grace that comes from our Lord Jesus Christ be the most real thing to you at all times, my brothers and sisters. May God make it so.